This is the MDT podcast.
A podcast for all healthcare professionals working with older adults. We are a multidisciplinary team educating about aging, MDT.
The MDT is brought to you by the Hearing Aid podcast team. We focus on a different topic each week to work with you to enhance your knowledge to help you look after older people.
Welcome to the MDT. I'm Ian Wilkinson. I'm a consultant geriatrician down in East Surrey, and today is the fifth episode of this MDT kindness series. And on my left, I am joined by...
I'm Jo Preston, and I'm a consultant geriatrician in South London.
Welcome, Jo, again.
Welcome you.
Welcome to our podcast. Welcome to our joint venture.
Thank you so much for having me here.
It's nice to have you. This episode, Jo, I'm excited about this one. So this is kind of the... It's episode 5, and it's just literally just struck me, you know, we've been planning this for a long time, but it's kind of the pivotal episode, I think, of this whole series, because this is the episode on kindness. This is where we're going to delve into kindness as part of the quiet leadership journey with Julian and leadership in the smallest of actions. This is where we're going to talk to an expert on the psychobiology of kindness, what actually is going on the inside when we do things that are kind and when we think about and look at things that are kind. And so, yeah, this I think is the pivotal
one. Nice. Yeah, I'm looking forward to it. It's good.
But before we sort of delve in too far, we've got two social media things this week.
Two. How kind.
I have brought two. Yes. The first is a tweet from Deacon Francis Valier, who is a deacon and an executive assistant. I think he's from America. And this is a tweet that is a picture from the Random Acts of Kindness Foundation, which is the second social media thing. It is a picture and it is two people holding hands, and it's a quote from the Dalai Lama. And it says, if you want others to be happy, practice compassion. If you want to be happy, practice compassion. And the second thing that led on to me looking at the Random Acts of Kindness. And there's an organization called Random Act of Kindness Foundation, and their website is randomactsofkindness.org. And they have three sections to their website. There is kindness at school, kindness at home, and kindness at work. And with each of them, they have a kindness challenge that you can download and encourage your team to do. It's a bit like a bingo game, you know, those sort of have you done these things. So there's a whole little grid, and the idea is the first person to complete all of the things in the grid wins.
How about we do that as our challenge for next week?
We could do that as a challenge for next week.
Yeah.
Yeah, we could do. How many years? There's 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 10, 15, 20, 25, 30, 35, 40, 40. There's 50 things on the page. So maybe what we do is we say we will give a prize to the first person that can show us 10 of them completed.
Sure.
Do we do that?
Yeah, sounds good.
Yeah, brilliant. Yeah. So if you do 10 of them, you need to tweet us a photo of the Random Acts of Kindness Challenge with the 10 that you've crossed off. Use the hashtag MDT Club. That's where we'll look for it. We are on Twitter at MDT_podcast. And we will get in touch with you if you do that, if you're the first person to do it, and I will send you an MDT book, one of the MDT books. Of which there are more coming, actually, but at the moment we've got one, but I think there are another two.
But that's another story for another day. Story.
Yeah, exactly.
But before we get into the main sort of scope of our episode today, Christina's been out on the wards of East Surrey talking to people about how they switch off and keep themselves balanced with their jobs.
I go to the gym, or I cook, or I play guitar.
So I go to the gym, I play a bit of guitar, try learn piano, and if I really want to relax, I do a bit of gaming.
Well, I used to play football, but now I can't. But most of the time, quite passionate about football, so I do follow it quite a lot. I used to like the adrenaline. You know, I'm not one of those people that tends to relax and puts on like a candle or like some music. I used to actually go out and play some sports, and then that's the time that I would zone out. Now, I haven't been able to do that, but I still find other things to do.
I try and run when I can and feel I've got the energy. I have developed an interest in naval history. Sometimes enjoy doing things like building Lego.
What I've really liked about these is that obviously I work on the wards, and so I know some of these people. And it's what I really like is getting to know that little bit extra about people, and sort of you can connect people on a slightly different level if you know a little bit more about what they do. We're now going to play a recording of a conversation that Joe and I had with Julian Stodd as part of the second bit of the Quiet Leadership. So this is the journey looking at leadership in the smallest of actions. And this second part is on kindness. Julian gave us some questions to think about a couple of weeks ago. And so we're going to take those questions and sort of just have a bit of a discussion.
The MDT Podcast.
This week we are continuing our journey through quiet leadership work. And so I'm going to welcome back Julian Stodd again. Julian, welcome.
Thank you. Good to be back.
And this week we are talking about kindness as the second part. And we had touched on this idea at the end of episode three, and you posed us a couple of questions, Julian. One was, why does kindness count? And then the second was, how can you grow with kindness in every day or in every action? Joe, what do you think? Why does kindness count?
I mean, like, the answer to this for me is very instinctual. It's like, well, it just does. Like, of course it does. If we're not bringing everything back to being kind, then what on earth is the point of anything that we're doing? You know, how do we value each other if we're not being kind? How do we perceive that we're valuing each other if we're not demonstrating that we're being kind to someone? And that could be kindness in your thoughts. So you may not say with the right tone or something, but you might say, you know, with the things you're thinking, the things you're planning and acting, that you are demonstrating kindness to someone else having a smoother life or making life easier for them. But if kindness weren't there, how, it just wouldn't work. There's no glue, right? There'd be no relationships. We, you know, everything would be very transactional. So it's not, why does it, like, how can it not count? You know, it's vital. And I think that there's, when we get short on time and busy and things, as everyone has done recently, we get quite short with each other. And that can sometimes be perceived as a lack of kindness for other people, a lack of caring how they feel, a lack of respect for them, undervaluing, all those kinds of things, when actually all it really means is that person's having a bad day. But as that builds up, it will start to be perceived and experienced as a lack of kindness. And then I think relationships just fall then. You can't do anything. And especially in our jobs, in the kind of area that we work in, we just have to be kind to older adults, right? They just, it's a generational respect thing. It's what we're here for, is to help them. If we're not being kind as we're doing that, then we're kind of being robots. Why not just let Google and AI just deliver these decisions? You know, I think that's the key thing that differentiates us from non-human algorithms. Have I articulated that very well? I'm not sure.
I mean, you said it, and hence you articulated it exactly as you should articulate it. This reflective journey, you know, there is no test at the end. There is no correct answer. Although it is interesting, because as I heard you talking about it, you described two things. You described systems and humans. You said, surely it's everything. You know, surely we need kindness. Well, you know, you're not alone in saying that. People overwhelmingly say that kindness matters to them. They'd say that they would choose a system, they would stay in a system where people were kind, more so than in one where they weren't. They describe it as being a very human thing. You know, so they say, well, people are kind, not systems. But it's also worth noting that we don't necessarily get paid for kindness. You know, you could start to think that there were two things. There's utility and there's our kind of humanity. So we get paid to do a job. And yet people often say, I couldn't do the job without the help of others. I need people to be invested, to give me their consensus and permission to be successful. So you sort of end up to act with utility and with kindness and indeed the other social currencies, you know, with trust. It's the same kind of thing. Can you be successful without trust? It's interesting. You know, it's not something that's bought from us. It's something we have to choose to invest.
Yeah, I think that strikes a chord to me, because I think by and large people are kind, but are people acting with kindness and with kindness as a forefront of their mind, or are they just behaving in the way in which the social norms for that group exist? And I think there's this sort of idea that I have about sort of playing or working heads up and sort of being aware and looking around. And I think, you know, the Six Nations Rugby has just been on, and you watch the different teams, and they clearly have a different skill level at assessing what is going on. You look at Ireland and France, they're all of their players, their heads up, they're looking around, they're actively going through that process, versus England and Italy that are perhaps more passively going through the process. You know, they know we're going to catch the ball and this is what we do with it, and this is what we do with it because we've practiced it. But actually, are they, you know, in the now and changing what they do based on what is in front of them? And I think it is very possible for us to go through the motions, and, you know, in with the motions is a degree of kindly type behavior. But I think that is different to acting with kindness and that sort of additional thought that is almost there in sort of, you know, I'm actively going to be kind now. You know, I'm going to buy you a cup of coffee or something that is a kindly gesture versus, you know, I'm not going to be rude to you, you know, but just going, you're right, great, and move on. You know, I think there is a difference.
What's interesting in that is that you inherently describe it as a limited currency. So, you know, this morning I walked down to the supermarket to get some more milk. And I saw, as I do every day, you know, someone who was standing outside begging for money. Today, I ignored them. Yesterday, I kind of caught their eye and smiled. But the thing that I've never done is buy them a cup of tea. And, you know, I could rationalize that in all sorts of ways. I could try to say, well, you know, there's good research that says you shouldn't just buy people a cup of tea. You should donate to a charity that will help them find their way out of it. But, you know, the human thing is to demonstrate some kind of kindness and compassion. And I didn't. Well, one other reason perhaps why I didn't is because we only have a certain amount of time for kindness, which might sound like a funny thing to say, but because kindness is generally perceived to be held within our action, and indeed sometimes the commitment of resource, you cannot be endlessly kind. Most people say in the research, you cannot be endlessly kind. You have to be somewhat selective. So we can start to consider, okay, well, you know, we've said that kindness does count. We seem to believe that intuitively. So, and we cannot be endlessly kind. So where do we spend our kindness? And one of the interesting things that comes out of that is that we tend to see kindness is more likely to be a cohesive force than a connecting one. So one reason why I may not have spent kindness on that person this morning was because I am spending kindness on a friend who I wish to support in a certain way, who I want to invest in, you know, just sending someone a WhatsApp message. To, you know, in the hope that you can connect or reinforce or add something into their day. And that can be interesting because when we say kindness counts, do we mean it matters for our sense of social structure and belonging, or is it to the good of the system as a whole?
But isn't that around coming back to that kind of fill your cup first kind of thing, that actually in the greater good, to be kind to yourself, to be kind to a few people rather than spread that too thin, may be overall the kindest thing to do. So you're still kind of maximizing your kindness, if you like.
It does, but then it will lead you to ask the question, as we should do really more broadly in society, so is kindness equally available to everyone? Or are some people structurally unable to access it? You know, is that possible? Could there be people in your own system, in your own organization, you know, people who work, but yet don't have access to the networks or the people or the time or the physical space or the opportunity to access kindness? Is the distribution uneven? And if so, who's responsible for that?
I think it plays, you know, a lot of these questions will do this, don't they? It plays on a number of levels, you know. Why does kindness count to me and the actions that I take to be kind to myself? Why does it count on my interactions with other people? Why does it count for my community and organization to be kind? You know, and I think there's layers upon layers upon layers on there.
I guess it's also maybe the kind of kindness that is required at the time and what we're kind of talking about that as being, because the kind thing to do sometimes might be to walk away from someone or to walk away from a situation. And that might outwardly not be perceived as kind, but actually is the kindest thing.
In the quiet leadership sessions I run, people often bring up this language of, you know, sometimes you have to be cruel to be kind, which sounds counterintuitive. If kindness is between me and you, and I do something that you perceive to be cruel, can that really be kind in the long run? Well, you know, possibly. So again, with my, you know, with my son this morning, he didn't want to clean his teeth. We had a big argument about it. I had to sort of threaten to withhold rights to the Thomas the Tank Engine story tonight. So he was upset. You know, he collapsed on the floor in floods of tears because I was cruel. But I could argue, well, I was cruel because, you know, learning to clean your teeth, it's kind of, it's not so much in my interest, it's in his interest to sort of learn that skill. So, of course, you know, as we become adults, we don't tend to threaten to withhold the Thomas the Tank Engine story, but we do actually, we just mask those behaviors in other ways. You know, we do try to influence people, and that may not be perceived as kind, but nonetheless, it could still be good for them.
And I think if the community is not structured right, also it's harder for that community to be kind. And I think of there's a Finnish educational theorist called Engström who sort of talks about sort of subject to object change mediated by some kind of mediating artifact or person or something. But actually there are distractors from that. You know, if the rules of the game are different, it's going to be hard for you to progress from left to right to your objective if actually you're being pulled further left, or if the community itself is not up for, I don't know, whatever it is, you know, you learning about something, or the division of labor isn't equal, or, you know, a whole host of things. They can all detract from what you would set something up to want to deliver and want to do.
I was in, it also made me think about, I can't remember which educational concept this is, but it's around going from knowing that you know nothing to knowing that you don't know everything, and the kind of expertise as you go across. And there's this really awkward period where you have to know that you don't know everything. That's really uncomfortable. And sometimes as an educator, your role is, or a supervisor or a mentor, whatever it is to point that out to someone, even though they won't like it, even though it will, they will not like you for it. It will make them feel really uncomfortable. But actually, in the long run, to not highlight that to them, the bits that they don't know and are, you know, just rolling around doing the wrong thing and getting themselves, I'm saying this really wrong, but, you know, in more of a tangle is not fair to them. So actually, although they won't like it, it will be difficult to do. Actually, you have to do that. It's your responsibility to do that, to allow them to progress.
What it speaks to for me is, again, this is a quiet leadership is about leadership in the smallest of actions. I'm not blind to the fact that, you know, it's easy to be an idiot when writing about kindness. It's easy to just say, oh, you know, life should be good. You should be kind to everybody. You'll be a better human being if you do it. Well, you know, that's not the worst message, to be fair. But try to take a slightly more structural view of this, which is to say, you know, people are kind. We generally are kind. Very few people are deliberately unkind, except in specific instances. You know, there are times when we wish to inflict pain on somebody because we're lashing out. But in general, we turn up at least with the potential for kindness. So we should be thinking about, you know, how is that impact felt? If we just use kindness as a cohesive force, there's nothing bad with that. It may make the people who are closest to us feel better. It may make their lives better. And that is an act of leadership to invest in a system to help people. But we could also stop to ask ourselves, are there people within our system to whom kindness is not available? And why would that be? And actually, is my responsibility to the whole system or just to my part of the system? It also speaks slightly to something you talked about at the start, Joe, which is, you know, what is even the point of having our organizations? Do organizations act in service of society, or does society act in service of organizations? It would be an argument that says we could deliver better healthcare outcomes if everybody stopped saying good morning to each other and stopped making cups of tea for each other. And if we squeezed an extra 8 minutes a day out of everybody across the whole system, we would deliver better clinical outcomes. Except we probably wouldn't, because we'd have a system which would implode because it would have lost its humanity. So we need to find a balance, and it's not a clear answer. But what we can be fairly sure about is if we don't think about kindness at all, it may exist within the system, but unequally. By thinking about it, about our intention, our action, our impact, about the way the whole landscape is covered, maybe that would tip us to look at ourselves and think, maybe I could act slightly differently once or twice a week. and it would make a real difference.
Julian, I think that leads on nicely to thinking about the second question that you posed us and about how we can grow with kindness in every action. And my thinking here, again, went down sort of two routes. There's the sort of, you know, how can I be more active about the kindness that I deliver? But then also, I think when I'm a recipient of kindness, you know, we know when someone's being, well, we think we know when someone's being kind, you know, you have a feeling and that is a nice feeling. And actually, what can I do with that feeling? You know, and I sort of felt that I could, you know, how do I grow? Well, I can promise that when I get that feeling, I pass it forward. You know, maybe not there and then, but I you know, I can pledge that at some point I will then pass that feeling forward onto someone else again. And so I will do something that to try and engender that. Yeah. And so I quite liked thinking about this, actually.
You know, I like that. This is sometimes I describe that this work is it's simply about being in practice, in your practice. You know, we will get through this day, whether we think about it or not, you know, hopefully. But if we at least pause at times and think, how am I making this journey? To see ourselves within the system, it's kind of this metacognitive act, you know, not just to be inside our head traveling through the system, but sometimes to pause and say, how have I gone through this system today? I found myself in a conversation this week with a group, and I'd been with them for a session around International Women's Day a couple of weeks ago in the UK. And they asked me, just being polite, they just said, how did you enjoy the session? And I'd been their guest, and I felt a certain duty to say I really enjoyed it, but I didn't. I said, I was furious. I said that I had to kind of leave early because I was just feeling just this lot of anger. I could tell I was sort of, it was bubbling up inside me, because what I heard was kind of a lot of rationalization of inequality rather than why we should do a bit more fighting to find more, a greater sense of equity and equality. But I shielded it. You know, I kept it within myself because I didn't want to rock the boat. I didn't want to be judged, I guess, for what I would think. So it made me think about how I had traveled through those days and how I had traveled through the weeks afterwards without really saying something that I felt needed to be said. And that really is what this work is about, you know, that as we roll forward, as we travel forward, as we go through this landscape, how do we pause and reflect and then say something, do something? Even if it's just one conversation with one person, even if you're just changing one outcome of one conversation in one day, then scale it up and a whole system changes.
I think my thoughts on this were quite inward. I think it made me think about slowing down each day and being a bit calmer each day. So kind of increasing my awareness and not being distracted by the flashing lights or the exciting thing or the deadline. You know, that was my kind of initial thought around this. So how do I grow my kindness every day? I think it's by trying to pause, trying to make myself pause a little bit more and see rather than just running.
Lovely. So I think have a think about those questions yourselves. Why does kindness count? And how can you grow with kindness in every action? And what can you do maybe today to grow a little bit with kindness and encourage that with others? And then in 2 weeks' time, Julian, we're going to be moving on and we're going to talk about fairness. And you've got a couple of questions for us to ponder in preparation for then.
When I created this body of work around quiet leadership, I settled on these four things: humility, kindness, fairness, and grace. And then I immediately panicked and thought, why am I spending 2 weeks, two sections to think about kindness and fairness? Surely they should go together. But the research showed that people experience them quite differently. Kindness tends to be experienced one-to-one. Fairness tends to be triangulated. That's what we'll be exploring in this in the next session. The way that it's you to me to the other. So I could act to you in a way that you think is fair, but then you discover that I've treated somebody else differently and suddenly it feels unfair. Now, within that, I wanted to explore a couple of ideas. And the first question to explore it is very simple. How do we experience fairness? So this may be a question to which you'd answer it with a story. This is how I have experienced fairness, or this is how I have seen fairness be experienced within my system. The second question is back to the idea of the tree growing in this ecosystem of quiet leadership. When we thought about kindness, we talked about the sapling being battered by the winds. But now the tree has grown into this magnificent monument in the landscape. The canopy is spread wide. People can shelter underneath the canopy from the midday sun. So as we find our power, as we find our strength within the system, the question is, does your power promote growth? If indeed it should. This is really a question about whether you spend your power on yourself to get more power, or whether you spend it or make it available somehow to others. Do you look up? Do you look down? Do you look to yourself? Do you look to others? So that second question, does your power promote growth?
Fantastic. Thank you, Julian. We will see you in a couple of weeks.
Well, I think that's been quite a good discussion, isn't it? Good sort of look into that from a few different angles, which has been nice.
And I think it's nice now because we can look at it from another angle, can't we?
Yeah, absolutely. So less from the sort of philosophical, what is it, how do we approach it, but what actually happens to us with kindness. So we have got an interview with David Freiberg, who has written some papers on the psychobiology of kindness.
The MDT Podcast.
We have a special guest on this episode now, and I'd like to introduce David Freiberg. So David is a physician in the States. He is an endocrinologist. He founded and is president of an organization called Envision Kindness, and we will perhaps talk about that in a little bit. But David's here today, and we're going to talk a bit about the psychobiology of caring and how kindness can be used as a stress reduction activity. I came across one of your articles, David, in the American Journal of Lifestyle Medicine. And it just really hit a point for me, I think, with what we're trying to achieve with this episode, or this series, rather. And I think one of the things is about how kindness is sort of manifested in positive social connections. And I wondered if we could start there and sort of have a chat about that.
Well, thank you first, Ian and Joe, for having me on your wonderful podcast. It's a pleasure to be here. So kindness and social connection. So just for background for folks who are listening. So as Ian mentioned, I'm an endocrinologist. I've been faculty at medical school. I've been in the pharmaceutical industry running something called translational medicine, which is the interface between how drugs are made early and then they're studied. And I've been a consultant leading teams of scientists from largely around the world, but mostly in the U.S. for solving problems on how we measure or diagnose disease. So you could take away from all of that that I love science, and in fact, I'm a nerd. It's an interesting blend because about 10 years ago, as a consultant, I was reading the news a lot more, got stressed, and saddened by what I was seeing. And as a pretty even guy who's blessed with a fair share of resource, I had to lean back and say, why am I so stressed? Which the nerd in me took to going to read the news, going back to the psychology literature to understand how media affects people. And there it was, and studies from the UK had shown that not only would seeing the news affect concern, for example, for people in Ukraine over the war, but reading about people in the Ukraine would affect their own lives. And so this spillover, or what psychologists called mood congruence, really touched me. And I leaned back and I thought, well, that's not fair. It's depriving people of a higher quality of life because it will disconnect them from others. It's going to I will get to that question that you asked, I promise. And it goes to the point of how stress itself interferes with our interrelationships on how we think, how we behave, how we feel. And this is this was a particularly blatant artifact, right? Where being subjected to news, which much of the news is just screaming at us. So I leaned back and thought, how could we do something about it? And and it's the creation of Kindness Media, which I'll come back to. So what struck me in the sojourn was how positive social connection, interpersonal connection, was a powerful buffer to stress. So everyone is subjected to a lot of different stressors. We all have them of varying degrees and hitting at different times. And there are things that we control and there are many of them that we can't, right? They're just externally imposed. And even something as trivial as the way that someone talks to someone else is a stress. And you see it show up, of course, in all of the data on loneliness, right? You in fact, in the UK have, you may still have a minister of loneliness, that people who are lonely have a more excess mortality of, in meta-analysis, 24%, but some studies as high as 40 to 50%. So loneliness itself, why does it cause that? There are a lot of reasons. But when you start to think about it, it's that nature wanted us to have positive social connection. So on the flip side, staying with the mortality discussion, volunteerism, people who volunteer regularly have mortality rates that are about 20% or so lower than those who don't. So now if we look at across a spectrum of social connection, from loneliness to volunteerism, you can get a very good idea that how important it is for health. And the reason is it probably ties back to induction of or buffering of a stress response. Now, the data are very clear, both epidemiologically and then biologically. You can show that even psychological stressors, not only, you know, fight or flight is very well known amongst even the lay population, but it also induces an inflammatory cascade. So we talk about disease as beginning at inflammation, immunocompetence, et cetera. And I am hard-pressed to think of a disease that isn't at least caused by or exacerbated by stress. Because stress also, of course, affects behavior.
And there's evidence around the pathophysiology of frailty being rooted in inflammation as well.
Yes. I think that most diseases, I mean, cardiovascular disease, right, is a great example. Diabetes is another example. Obesity itself has inflammation associated with body habitus, but have to be thinking about how we're driving these things. And then stress, of course, affects how people make decisions in a more day-to-day basis rather than over years. It affects how they can manage their weight, what they choose to drink, because some people are in such pain that they have to reach for something to quench the pain of their existence. And I find that incredibly troubling. And so how do we help them to become less stressed? And that will allow for good things to manifest and better health. So I leaned back and in looking at all of this, positive interpersonal connection was the key. But how do you do that is then really the next question. And so in studying this and in thinking about also that, you know, what'd be great, you could say, well, you could relieve my stress by making my work conditions better. You could relieve my stress by providing, you know, people who don't have resources with, you know, money, et cetera, with better incomes. And all of those things, of course, are true, but they're just much more challenging to navigate and also very specific. And I don't want to be confusing. They need to be done. The right things need to be done for the right reasons. But the first thing is, can we influence how people respond to those stressors? So what intrigued me as I delved into this is as I started to study the biology of positive interpersonal connection was that this was, it just wasn't a nice thing. It was what was mandated by nature. And I admire, you know, the father of modern, you know, of evolutionary theory, right, Darwin, because many people talk about, quote, Darwin in terms of survival of the fittest, even though Darwin didn't originally say it. It was another Brit, Herbert Spencer, as I understand. But Darwin in his second book was puzzling over why organisms would sacrifice for each other. And so this was not in Origin of the Species, it was in Descent of Man. And what he came to was that for an individual organism to survive, selfishness, self-preservation was necessary. For a species to survive, sacrifice for others was necessary. And you can see lots of examples of it in ants, bats, rats, dolphins. They all, and not just within species, but even across species. And I'm sure you've heard those or seen those kinds of stories. So there's lots of data, and evolutionary psychologists have taken this up to say we're actually wired for kindness. This is why, so I promised Ian I'd come back to it. I hope I am. And that is, kindness isn't just a moral thing that is prescribed as by social standards or religious standard or something like that, that's externally imposed. Contrary to what many people might believe, kindness, the willingness to care for others, is embedded in our circuitry. It is part of our nature. And it is the force for survival. And that's why I shared the mortality rates across this, because, you know, people who are lonely, they're isolated, right? But it's also, you know, going to the biology again, it's really interesting that it's an extremely painful, state. Social isolation, right? Bullying, ostracism, all of these things are painful. Which, if you look at from a biologic perspective, if pain centers are being activated, it's our neurologic system's way of saying, fix this. Because we move away, right, from pain towards pleasure. And so the pain is like we get a cut and it's like, oh, I've hurt myself. I need to tend to it. The pain of isolation isn't intended to say, to drive us to want to connect.
Yeah, pain's kind of a pre-warning of danger, isn't it? I guess in some ways, you know, and an injury. And this is, that exactly chimes with that, I think.
I think that's something that we saw obviously a lot through COVID and people started to see really, really magnified was that pain. And there were quite a few things written about, you know, the feeling of loneliness and what that feels like to be isolated, and that there's a kind of physical feeling to it as well, which I think a lot of people hadn't either experienced before or had enough people sort of thinking about it together to express and articulate. But I think that was really... that really came through quite a lot at that time, wasn't it? It became less taboo to discuss what it felt like to be lonely as well. And obviously Absolutely. We're going to be seeing people who have, you know, we've lived through it and our patients have lived through that as well. So recognizing that that will be an experience for a lot of them.
And if we think about, if we're thinking about that as a stressor, and you both are geriatricians, right? And so being disabled, being alone, these are huge stressors as people get isolated or being forced to change their environment because of their dependencies. I then can see the biology shifting in them, right? And so they're having now inflammatory cascades. And if we think about it as we're constantly healing ourselves, right? Tissue is breaking down and being repaired. And the aging process, of course, is the diminution of the ability to adequately repair tissue damage. and for different reasons. But now imagine that you accelerate damage and inhibit wound healing. So if we look at our tissue turnover, our rejuvenation as wound healing, then by adding these stressors, which are external in many ways, right, where we're stuck, it just worsens health. It's really a way of thinking about driving or shifting public health by lowering the response to stress. I hope that makes sense.
Yeah. So I guess what we're saying is that if you are living in an isolated way and you are not interacting and don't have a lot of social connectivity, a stress reaction will be set up. And that leads to an inflammatory cascade that is negative for you. But if you engage in lots of pro-social behaviors, you care for others, others care for you, you have a high degree of empathy, compassion, generosity, then you're sort of buffered against some of those pro-inflammatory changes that might happen with a stressor event.
Yes. And then if we took it, add another layer to it and say, this stress is going to affect how I think. So now we have, as people are aging, right, cognitive function is declining slightly. And now they're going to have to make decisions. Maybe it's a decision about taking medications. Maybe it's a decision about what food to eat. Maybe it's a decision about, oh, I could just walk outside without shoes, you know, because I'm only going out for a second. And small decisions then result in perhaps a new injury. Things that might have otherwise not taken place. And then that sets in another problem. And so, you know, there's an aphorism I use taught to me by one of my teachers, the worse it gets, the worse it gets. So that's the downward spiral, right? And then things happen or somebody has prescribed a medication to treat a problem that could have been avoided and then has problems due to the medication.
I guess that's part of the root of we have something in the UK started a few years ago now called social prescribing, which I've always been bothered by the prescribing aspect of it because it should be more, you know, life than that, than medicalizing it. But hearing you talk about that kind of puts that back in that context, saying actually, as a measure for your health, this is an intervention that will really, really help. I probably still object to the word prescribing because I think we're still over medicalizing then, but. You can see then that offset.
You know? Absolutely. I actually have come to believe that that's probably one of the most important things that people need for health. You need enough financial, you know, resource. So, you know, you fulfilled, if you think about it as Maslow's pyramid and the basic needs, et cetera. But as you go up Maslow's pyramid, right, and Viktor Frankl emphasized this, it's the connection that provides purpose and meaning to life. And it's true for the patients, it's true for the docs, it's true for and nurses, it's true for every single person. So, and I think about this a lot, especially as someone who spent years working on developing drugs. Pharmacologically, I cannot imagine something better than social connection. So when you say about the prescription, yes, I get it. The problem is that many physicians, caregivers, the access to that and the infrastructure to support it is small. So my interest would have been is, okay, how do you have the population help each other? It's not a linear, Mrs. Smith is lonely, we need to help her. And that's also very true. And I'm not minimizing that at all. But what if we could enjoin others, whether they're neighbors, community members, and they have a spirit of reaching out? Because technology has also isolated us. Is allowed for the facilitation of isolating us. But to go back to the biology for a second and then emphasize this. So, some might object to that my statement that kindness is an innate quality. But there are lots of other ways to look at this. One of them is the maternal bond. So it was written, these are all citations from evolutionary psychologists from Darwin on, is if the nature of human beings was solely self-centered, why would a mother sacrifice herself to protect and feed and care for her offspring? Because if you think about it, the mother should, you know, okay, give birth and go on your way. But, and you can show with through studies with oxytocin and polymorphisms to the oxytocin receptor, there are very good data to suggest that this is a biologically mediated event that is critical for survival. Because if we look at the lens of nature wants us to survive, nature wants us to reproduce, and the system is entirely geared, the teleology works really well because it's entirely geared to preserving that, to allowing for survival, and not of just one, but of many. And so I look at it as innately, people are imbued with kindness.
I just wanted to give what I think is a relevant example there, which is there's quite, you know, the London Tube, you said you're a medical student, the elective in London, you know, the Tube, people don't talk to each other. It's very, you know, there are social rules, right? A child or a baby gets on and everybody is cooing at that child. It's like it breaks down all of the rules, like everyone just melts. And it's such a funny thing to watch because it's so like the unwritten social rules of the Tube are so strong. But a child gets on and it changes everything. I mean, people are still trying to be a bit reserved about it, but it totally just shifts. And I think that's quite a nice example of that emotion. Like you have no connection to that child, you have no connection to that baby, whatever, but it doesn't stop people from, you know, trying to help entertain it, you know, and sort of.
So simply seeing it without it necessarily being your child stirs this innate drive, right? That's a very nice observation. Thank you. I think that what all of this tells us, Ian, to your original question, is that the drive is present for us to do well. We get misled because we have two drives, right? We have a drive for self-preservation and a drive for other preservation. And society too often, you know, emphasizes the self-preservation aspects, right? There's this rise in narcissism that's been very well documented. And it's, thinking about me. So, but this other piece is so strong. It's so powerful. So we stumbled into, so how I got into this is like, I thought, okay, well, this isn't right that people would get stressed and disconnected from one another because of, you know, the news. And what you're not hearing, I hope, is a condemnation of the news. It's not at all like that, or even a severe criticism. It's really saying we need to know that kind of stuff, but we need balance. And I'm an endocrinologist, as you know, so you go to Midas, you get a muffler. I don't know if they have Midas in the UK. It's a shop where they put in mufflers, and their slogan was, you go to Midas, you get a muffler. So you go to a certain place, and you know the answer that you're going to get or the thing that you're going to buy. Sorry. I'm explaining an Americanism. Good. Okay. So I came to call it the visual diet, that what we take in from media, right, we're all taking in thousands of pieces that are subconsciously affecting us. Whether we, you know, as by the term subconscious, it's obviously we don't know it and we don't realize it as much. But just like, for example, images of food or drink make you hungry or thirsty, right? It's not because of anything else. It's what psychologists call priming. Okay. So I leaned back and I thought, well, you know, this is really unfair. What could I do? But then I'm an endocrinologist. What could I do about this? I know a bit about metabolism, but not a lot else. And I thought, well, what if we had images of kindness and compassion and we shared them with people and helped rebalance this visual diet? And so I looked around and I was taught pretty well at the pharma company how to think about the customer and what's needed and is someone else already doing this? And if so, that would be, you know, great. You know, maybe I could help them. But it came about because I had a love of photography since I was a child. And there wasn't anything there. So it became a put up or shut up moment. And you couldn't find, although there are stories, of course, on the internet, that are, you know, wonderful and warm, they're harder to access and couldn't be used on a regular basis, right, without violating copyright law and that kind of thing. So we had to figure out a way to do this. And so we eventually gathered our own portfolio over the years by an international kindness photography contest in which we get images. And then at the same time, people were saying, well, look, you're a scientist. You know, don't just put this out, do science with it. And of course, I was reluctant because scientists are really trained, right? You stay in your lane. You know about endocrinology and specifically human protein metabolism is what my expertise was in academia. That's what you do. So we recruited some wonderful psychologists who knew what they were doing, including Barbara Fredrickson at University of North Carolina, Chapel Hill. She's a really wonderful, remarkable, positive psychologist. Doug Gentile at Iowa State. He's a fantastic person who is an expert in how video games affect children. And we decided to do a study. And in the first study we did with still images, using standard scales, what blew everyone away was that the kindness images, which are pictures of a woman in distress on a dark stairwell being comforted by a police officer, a sea of shaven heads with a young man looking up who's going for chemotherapy, a young man escorting two elderly women to their car, compared to typical positive images, puppies in a basket, bunnies, flowers, even a mother and child, had double the impact on happiness, love, trust, optimism, gratitude, soaring increases in sympathy that the positive images didn't touch. And the positive images, just to tell you, came from a standard set that psychologists had used for years. And we also included negative and neutral images. And so those were just, so they weren't even, you know, they're not mentionable here because they were obvious, the differences. But everyone was struck by this. And so what we ended up doing is, it was screaming at me because we've never seen 100% effect in any research I've done. You know, if you get 20, 30%, you're very happy. So it said, pay attention. There's something important here. And the paying attention made me go back and study a lot of the biology and psychology we just discussed and said, this isn't just a nice thing to do. This is a public health thing. And made me recommit. So what we ended up doing is figuring some other things out on the way and decided that the best way to reach people was to stream it right into where they're stressed. Rather than just putting it out on the internet, reach them where they need it the most. Which, of course, required us another level because now you have to convince somebody else to put it in their setting. So we turned the images into video using a modification of Ken Burns' method. Ken Burns, the American documentarian, you may have seen some of his pieces. But the bottom line is he doesn't sit still on a still image, so to speak. He keeps it moving, so because the eye is drawn to motion. And then we made complementary content, ideas about empathy and gratitude and original pieces and humor and quotes, because people like different things. And I want to just be sure that we can find something that Mrs. Smith and Mr. Jones and many others could engage with. And we call it, it's a program, and Envision Kindness is a nonprofit or a charity by the UK, Inspire. And then we studied it. And we streamed it into, we started with a pediatric dentist's office, and in that office, with a few minutes compared to children's commercial television. So not even the news, but something that I'd call neutral to slightly positive. The parents and staff were rapidly uplifted. They were happier. They were calmer. They were more generous making a donation to a needy family, an actual donation. And that study was done with three academic media psychologists and was published. And based on that, then the pandemic hit, which set, you know, us back for a while doing anything, understandably. But eventually we entered into a hospital and into another dentist's office and an urgent care. And the data could be just, the results could be summarized by it rapidly affects how people feel. A 2-minute clip is enough. It requires no training to do. And people had decreased irritation and stress and sadness and anxiety. They had more, they were happier and calmer as we had observed before, but they also felt connected to others and were more cared for. When we streamed it into hallways on inpatient floors, and this was a staff-based study, we have evidence that there was a small but significant effect on how people were treating each other. The staff, particularly the nurses, and these are nurses, aides, et cetera, and there were roughly a little under 200 people, staff members, who took the survey before and then after. We've now been, have data from an emergency room, et cetera. They all point in the same direction. And to be frank, it is exactly the same or very similar results to what's been seen in academic studies for many years. You can prime people to reconnect with that innate sense to want to care for others simply by showing them, you know, imagery. So there's a lot here. I know I just blurted a bunch out, but I hope that that's of interest, and it works in children. We're in a school also. It has a, to me, the potential for helping people just reconnect with their own humanity. And from that, and the way that they treat others, many other wonderful things can manifest. So I should probably pause and let you interject.
That's great. That's really good. Thank you. That was really, really interesting. And if people want to find more, they can go to the website, which is envisionkindness.org.
There's some research that I read a few years ago around having pictures of nature or nature actually visible from hospital rooms, and it reducing the need for analgesia post-op, improving recovery and that kind of thing. So it sounds quite similar to that kind of very natural, getting back to, you know, the basics of who we are as humans and what we need as humans, and that very sort of basic level really helping so much in very measurable ways. and also reminded me of something else we've talked about in the series, a book called Compassionate Leadership, which showed that sort of different adapting your interactions and your consultations with people can improve. It takes like an extra 20 seconds or something, like it doesn't take very long. But that style can improve concordance, compliance, like, and lead to, you know, reductions in mortality, improvement in like objective biochemical measures of disease control. And I think that's what's so interesting about this stuff, isn't it? Is we spend all this time and energy thinking about like the really highbrow stuff, but actually it's really that day-to-day, person-to-person stuff that can make such a massive difference for ourselves, for each other, and for our patients that we're working with as well. What would your kind of tips be for people trying to do that sort of in that kind of high pressured or tense sort of situation? Because it's one of those things that people would be like, oh yeah, I don't have time for that, but obviously it's so important. It's not true, but it's kind of seen as an optional niceness, isn't it, rather than a necessity sometimes in those time pressured situations.
So there are, you had some wonderful comments. Thank you. The nature media does work as calming. I think there's something special about when you see two living organisms, doesn't have to be two humans, interacting in a gentle way. But it's definitely spot on. And there are several studies that nurses fared better when there was a window, when the patients had earlier discharge rates, when there was a window with a nice view. So it definitely ties to that. My goal for the media is actually, it's for both patients and staff, recognizing that they're all under stress. So if the patient comes in for this brief encounter in a calmer, better space, and the staff are in a calmer, better space, then what I imagine, we're looking at documenting this soon in a study, is the quality of their interaction will rise. When the quality of that interaction rises, they'll listen better, they'll communicate better, and they'll care more about each other and what each other has to say. In the end of the day, even though some of this may take a little bit more time in terms of talking, we're not, the expression, kicking the can down the road. The patients, I would predict, and be interested in your thoughts, is patients will do better. And when the patients do better, it'll also be more satisfying to the caregiver, because that's, as I think what you said earlier, that's what they're there for. That's why they entered the field. So there's a virtuous cycle that can be created out of this that includes trust, because the number one thing, right, for trust from a for a patient to a doc is, does the doc care about me? It's not about the diploma on the wall, although confidence is there, but it's, do they care? And the number one thing, I think, for caring is, are they listening to me? So the other piece in here, just to add emphasis as we get ready to close, is the opposite is about what incivility does. And while people think, you know, incivility is just part and, you know, parcel of existing in medicine, they need to understand that it affects cognitive function and therefore performance. So there's a wonderful study, if you have not seen it, from Dan Katz at Mount Sinai and his colleagues. They took anesthesiology residents in a simulated surgery. And then they ask, the simulation is a routine endeavor that they do. And they give them either one of two surgeon types. One surgeon is pleasant. Professional comes in. Good morning. This is Mrs. Smith. She has X, Y, and Z. This is what we're going to be doing today. These are the problems I anticipate. And are there any questions, you know, or concerns? The group they call an intervention group is, surgeon comes in and berates the nurses, not the anesthesiology residents. Then they look at how, of course, this is not a smooth sailing simulation, and Mrs. Smith has an intra-abdominal hemorrhage and drops her pressure, and they're watching how the residents and measuring how the residents react. Top line, 91% of the polite surgeon group pass, 64% of the rude surgeon group pass. And remember, they only witnessed the incivility. They were not the object of it. And why did they fail? They didn't put in a line soon enough. They didn't back off the anesthetic. They were less likely to order bloods, and they definitely didn't want to talk to the surgeon. And yet, even after all of that, they surveyed them and said and asked, "How did you think you did?" They all said, "Fine. We did well." And it's not a one-off study. It's a beautifully done study, but it's not one-off. This NICU in Israel, university setting simulation, and it's a patient simulation in the way, because a parent actor comes into the simulation and at the top of her lungs said, "I knew we should have gone to a better hospital where they don't practice third world medicine," then leaves. That's it. And you see the same thing, and dental students, the same thing. So kindness, if we look at kindness as the opposite, right, of a way to mitigate incivility, has direct import. And for all the physicians, for how people perform and the quality of care, and for all the physicians who are still listening, please, you're not immune. I'm not immune. This happens because of subconscious processes that are out of our control. So we have to be nicer to each other. And media is just a way to help kickstart that.
There's a really nice website, which I'm sure you've seen, but our listeners may not have, called civilitysaveslives.com. And that it's really worth checking out. And they've made infographics. So that study you were talking about, the anaesthetist, they've created like a nice infographic around that. And I think they do a podcast just looking at it now, and lots of different resources and recapping some of their evidence. So definitely worth checking out if you want to read a little bit more about that as well.
Absolutely. It's a wonderful initiative. And I know that the fellow runs it. He's a fantastic guy. An ER doc. And I apologize to him on the air. I am blanking. But that's a sign of my age, not of him.
I think all of that plays into the human factors work that people are starting to do more and more now as well. And it's, fantastic. Thank you very, very much,
Thank
David.
Thank you. It's been really nice. Really interesting.
Really, really, really good. Really nice to talk to you. And I will put a link to your website on our website. So if you want to find out more about David's work, then please head on down to the website, which is www.hearingaidpodcast.org.uk. And if you follow the link to this episode, you'll see all of that stuff there.
Well, it's a pleasure to meet you. And thank you so much again for your kind invitation.
The MDT Podcast.
And I think that was really interesting, just having that deep dive into some of David's research and some of the stuff that the organization he's founded, and just sort of listening about the amazing stuff that they've done over the last few years.
I think it brings back a few things that have come up over previous episodes that we've done, where we talked about other papers that show changes in inflammatory markers with, you know, discrimination, social and health inequalities, and, you know, the biological changes that happen with loneliness. It's really interesting, I think, to start to be able to connect those things up and see what's happening and show that it is changing the way that we live and we exist. Really fascinating stuff, I think.
Yeah.
Been a really good episode.
Really good episode.
If we may say so ourselves.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. So we're going to wrap the episode up with the two final bits.
We've set you the challenge earlier today, so we don't need to do that. But we do have another breathing exercise for you to try this week. But first, we're going to hear from our faculty and how they found last week's.
Hi, it's Sophie here. And these are my thoughts on the triangle breathing exercises, which I think from hearing what everyone else has said as well, I'm in the same boat. I've really enjoyed these. I think they've been my favourite so far. And I think the visualising the shape to help with the breathing is really up my street.
I think that was interesting. Again, just hearing how how different people are finding it and how useful, actually, it's starting to be for people.
And here is your challenge for this week from Jess.
The MDT Podcast.
Hello and welcome to week 5 of the MDT Breathing Challenge. So for this week's practice, we'll do something called box breathing. It's a new technique from the whiskey breathing category, and it's something that's used by Navy SEALs and the US military to calm and focus the nervous system. So if you visualize the image of a box out in front of you, and on each side of the box, there's going to be a 4 count. So on the left side, it's a 4 count on the way in as we breathe in. At the top of the box, we're going to hold our breath for 4. On the right side of the box, we exhale for 4. And at the bottom, we hold the breath out for a count of 4. So we're holding our breath both at the top and at the bottom of this breath. With box breathing and all of the whiskey breathing techniques, we're slowing the breath down to less than 3 breaths per minute. It's a very strong parasympathetic nervous system stimulating practice designed to make you very relaxed. This practice also helps to train the body to tolerate more carbon dioxide, which is a vasodilator and a bronchodilator. So due to something called the Bohr effect, the more carbon dioxide that we have in our systems, the better able we are to absorb oxygen on a cellular level in our muscles and organs, and the more relaxed we feel. This means that when we're attempting to cool our nerves to relieve stress and anxiety, it can be helpful to boost the amount of carbon dioxide in our system. For some of you, the breathing rate might be a little too slow. If that's the case, just flick back to last week's practice, triangle breathing. That pattern might be a little bit more accessible for you. You can do this seated on the ground, sitting in a chair. If you are in a chair, just remember to move your back away from the support and plant your feet on the ground. You can also do this one lying on your bed. I recommend placing one hand on your heart and one hand on your belly. So let's begin. Just closing your eyes, relaxing your shoulders, relaxing your body, placing your hand on your heart and your hand on your belly if you wish. And let's begin by breathing in through both nostrils for 1, 2, 3, 4. Hold your breath. 2, 3, 4. Exhale. 3, 2, 1. Hold the breath out. 3, 2, 1. Inhale, 2, 3, 4, hold, 2, 3, 4, exhale, 3, 2, 1, hold, 3, 2, 1, in, 2, 3, 4, hold, 2, 3, 4, exhale, 3, 2, 1, hold, 3, 2, 1, in, 2, 3, 4, hold, 2, 3, 4, exhale, 3, 2, 1, hold, 3, 2, 1, in, 2, 3, 4, hold, 2, 3, 4, out, 3, 2, 1, hold, 3, 2, 1, in, 2, 3, 4, hold, 2, 3, 4, out, 3, 2, 1, hold, 3, 2, 1, in, 2, 3, 4, hold, 2, 3, 4, out, 3, 2, 1, hold, 3, 2, 1, in, 2, 3, 4, hold, 2, 3, 4, out, 3, 2, 1, hold, 3, 2, 1, In, 2, 3, 4. Hold, 2, 3, 4. Out, 3, 2, 1. Hold, 3, 2, 1. Last round in, 2, 3, 4. Hold, 2, 3, 4. Out, 3, 2, 1. Hold, 3, 2, 1. And just relax and breathe normally. You can release your arms down to your sides. And just take a moment to observe the effects of that practice on you, just noticing what you notice, noticing how your body feels. And with this, really, the relaxation is in the exhalation. We're slowing the breath down to less than 3 breaths per minute. We're slowing our heart rate, lowering our blood pressure, cooling our body. And because we've dramatically slowed the breath, it's quite normal to feel quite sleepy. It's normal to feel very relaxed. So this is an ideal practice to practice before bed. So practice this daily before going to bed and just note down the effects on the quality of your sleep. Thanks for joining me. Keep up the good work and I'll see you back here again next week.
So let's know your thoughts. Use the hashtag MDT Club on Twitter, where we are at MDT_podcast. If you go along to the website for this current series and click on open that up, there's a form that will appear. And if you fill that in, you'll get access to a super secret little extra bit of the website that's got loads of information about Jess, what she does, and also a load of extra additional resources that she's given us that are not all included within the podcast episode. So please have a dig around, have a listen. Also on that page are all of the breathing exercises in one place. So if you wanted to do them with your team or whatever, and you didn't want to go through the whole episode, I mean, I don't know why you wouldn't, but if you didn't, they are there where you can just access just the breathing bits.
It's like a website version of the TARDIS.
It is a bit like the website version of the TARDIS. This is quite true. Yeah. Doesn't move around quite as much as the TARDIS. And I'm not entirely sure it can move in time and space. But other than that, it's pretty much like a small TARDIS. Yeah. And on that note, we will see you next week. Or maybe last week, depending on the TARDISness of it all.
The MDT will reconvene numerically probably in 1 week time, but you know.
The MDT Podcast.